and welcome to the Classicist Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, here with Victor Davis Hanson, the Morton and Ely Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, immigration has been in the news a lot lately, and so I figured for our conversation today, I'd just like to start us off with a look at how the liberal thinking and liberal rhetoric around that issue seems to have been changing lately. After we had all this outcry over parents being separated from children at the border, it's really sort of gone into high dudgeon. And two talking points have started to become mantras. The first, just within the week or so prior to us recording this, is that we should abolish ICE. It's the Immigration and Customs Enforcement. You're hearing that now from some progressive politicians. And the second, which is still a little bit more the provenance of the activists, that we should maybe just get rid of borders, that they're inherently oppressive. When you hear things like this, do you think that something fundamental has changed and the left has been radicalized? Or is it maybe just that they've found a moment where they felt comfortable to let the mask drop?
Yeah, I think the problem is a mixture of both, that they don't have political power, remember. They don't have the Senate. They don't have the House. They don't have the state legislatures. They don't have the governorships. They don't have the Supreme Court, and they surely don't have the presidencies. And so that's building. And after we've tried the Emoluments Clause, the 25th Amendment, the Assassination Sheik, suing for voting machines, the Mueller supposed collusion, all of these tropes have fizzled. And in fact, they're juxtaposed to very good news on the economy, foreign policy successes, energy development, and they just can't get Trump back down to the 30s, which would be necessary to have for sure to win the midterms and to impeach him. So they're getting more and more shrill, I think, the more that they get frustrated. They just can't find the magic bullet to get rid of him, if I could use that harsh imagery. And so now they thought, well, you know, the Strzok thing is coming up, and there's not good news on the Mueller front. So let's go do this psychodrama down at the border, which is basically a rehash or of 2014 with Obama. But this time it's Trump-Hitler, and they thought that that would dominate the news cycle. For a while, it might have. Trump was kind of a little bit of clumsy with the optics about it. But once he sort of called their bluff and said, okay, I'll detain the parents with the children and keep the family unit intact. Well, then their fallback position was, well, you got to let them all go. And then from that, you've got to let them all go. It's let's get rid of ICE. And then from let's get rid of ICE, let's have no immigration law at all. And that's a winning issue for Trump. I think Mark Penn had a poll today, and the Haas Center here in UC Berkeley in California had one about a month ago that pretty much show that the majority of even Californians, not to mention the American public, favors border security, favors deporting people who come here illegally. So that's not going to be a winning issue for the Democrats. And I think that explains a lot of their frustration.
Talk to me about the disconnect between the rhetoric and the reality. You wrote a piece recently for National Review in which you said, quoting you here, it's almost as if the louder one rails about unfair border enforcement, the more likely one is to avoid encounters with actual illegal immigrants. You also had some suggestions for how to remedy that. Give us your diagnosis here.
Well, you know, I'm looking out the window right now at a house down the road here about an eighth of a mile where there must be at least 40 people. I knew the family farmers in that house and the one across the road, and they're all improperly zoned. I mean, in the sense that these Winnebagos they have Romex, they don't have, they have hoses for water, they have porta potties. And these little rural farmhouses in this depressed part of California, which per capita income is less than Appalachia, in this part of the country, it's all illegal. And the people who are championing, even the upper middle class Mexican-American cohort, they don't live here and they don't know anything about it and they don't want to live here. And so I thought maybe one of the ways that we could discuss this rationally would be to have people's rhetoric match their own reality. So I suggested, you know, that there's 5,000 colleges, universities, and most of their dorms are half empty. when I walked across the Stanford campus last week, first thing I noticed was that there's beautiful dorms. I walked by the law school and I said, oh my gosh, this is a very invaluable legal source. And then I went over to the medical school and I thought, wow, what an asset this would be. And because the federal government often contracts to private caregivers or adoptive parents, why not just, you know, tell Stanford or USC or Berkeley, you know, for $1,000 a person per month, would you please put them in your dorms? And then the kids could be interns. They wouldn't have to go to, you know, Yahoo or Facebook. They could intern on campus helping the so-called other. And then I also suggested that maybe in a place like Santa Monica or Palo Alto, where we see these private academies sprouting up as if it's the old South during desegregation, you know, Sacred Heart and Castilea and Harker and the Menlo School, places like that that dot the area around Stanford, why not have those parents take their kids out of those private academies and put them in, you know, Redwood City and Palo Alto and all these other schools where there's an influx of minorities, and then they could understand the problems. But they don't want to do that. And instead, they want to romanticize illegal immigrants. And illegal immigrants are just people from now mostly Oaxaca and Central America, and they're from the poorest regions in the United States, and they come up here with no knowledge. So, and I live next to them. I know them. I talk to them. But when I read statistics that they don't commit crimes more than Native, then I ask myself, well, where did the 1 million false identities come from that the IRS reported this year among illegal immigrants? And the answer is, I'm one of them. And it's not a good feeling to lose your identity and have somebody be writing checks on your name with your router number. Or I haven't seen people throw skinned dogs and dogs on ropes from dog fights in a long time. Or who thought in 2018 that at night you'd hear cockfighting in the air, which I do a lot. And when I walk my dogs at night, and just we don't know what we're going to find. We found a dead body. We found stripped down cars. We find hypodermic needles piled up. We find people beating up their girlfriends. And I don't know that's what you would expect from an unassimilated illegal cohort that comes into your country. And the first thing it does is break the law. And then second thing it does is break the law by residing here. And the third thing it does often is having a false identity. So all of these things are the realities that a lot of Americans deal with. And it's a world away from Dianne Feinstein and Nancy Pelosi or Mark Zuckerberg that have these palatial estates. And they virtue signal as a way of balancing their apartheid existences.
Let's talk a little bit about the situation on the ground in Mexico, where they look primed to elect a pretty anti-American new president here just in the next few days. And you recently wrote a big piece, this is also a National Review, on the dynamics down there. And in this piece, you argue that when it comes to the tensions between the U.S. and Mexico, you can make a pretty good case that Mexico is the aggressor. Make that case for us.
Well, the first thing I did was I went back 34 years ago and looked at the rhetoric when Bill Clinton was selling NAFTA in 1994. And some of the promises that were made are kind of surreal. There was the idea that within two or three decades, I think the word was equalization. So Canada and Mexico and the United States would roughly be the same. They would have constitutional government. They'd have transparency. Trade would be kind of a cure-all, and free market economics would bring with it a rising standard of living, et cetera, et cetera. There wouldn't be any illegal immigration, because why would you want to leave Mexico when it achieved parity? But instead, we inherited from NAFTA the worst of both worlds. By that, I mean we have a $71 billion deficit with Mexico. That's higher than any other country except for China, higher than Japan, higher than South Korea, higher than Germany. And then we have another $20 billion going out of the country for smuggling, drugs, cartel money. And then we have another $30 billion going out of the country for remittances from the 11 to 20 million illegal aliens nationwide. But many of them are on some sort of state or local or federal social services. So basically this taxpayer is making up that difference to free up cash to send back to Mexico. And if that were not enough, we have about a third of all federal prisoners are Mexican nationals. Here in California, we have 30,000 Mexican nationals in the state penal institutions. And then, of course, we have one quarter of all Californians were not born in the United States. And we have one fifth of the state lives in poverty. One third of all welfare recipients are here. So these are all connected. And Mexico, my question was, is Mexico, given all that, is it a friend, is it a neutral, or is it an enemy? Because the next likely president on July 1st, Mr. Obrador, has said not only that does he feel he has a sovereign right to champion people here illegally inside the United States, but he has advocated anybody who wants to leave Mexico, i.e. indigenous people who are poor and he feels are a drag on the state of Mexico, they should leave and go to the United States. And he knows that if they should, they become a powerful expatriate community the further and longer they're away from Mexico. And then they'll send more remittances, and then he'll have a safety valve, sort of a Frederick Jackson Turner effect where he doesn't have social protest. So given all that, I just don't think that NAFTA worked out very well. I don't think that Mexico is an ally or even a neutral. It's now a belligerent.
So if that's the case, and if the Trump administration was looking to recalibrate the relationship with Mexico, put them on notice that things are going to change, what are some of the tangible steps that you'd recommend they take?
The first thing I think they should do is they should put a tax on all money sent back to Mexico by anybody, 10%. And that would raise about $3 or $4 billion a year, and they should use that money to start immediately paying for the wall. And then they should pass a law that anybody who's on public assistance who has found out it's a felony to be on public assistance and to send money out of the country. That would be a second thing that I would do. And then the third, I would, of course, have E-Verify and make it a felony to hire somebody knowingly who was here illegally. And then we get into really rough existential questions. And I would say that anybody who came here within the last 2 years on the scent of amnesty should be deported. And anybody who has committed a felony should be deported. And anybody who has no record of work, that is, they either don't have a work W-2 or they don't have proof of employment, but they've been on public assistance, they should be deported. And I think you'd end up maybe of the, say, 12 million, you'd probably end up with about 8 million that have been here, say, 3 or 4 years. They have a work record and they have no criminal record that we know of. And then I would say to them, you can apply for a green card, not amnesty, a green card. And then that will be adjudicated like anybody else in the world that wants a green card. And whether they should have to go back to Mexico or do it here is I understand that's a divisive question, but I would have no problem letting them stay here, but if they wanted to apply for a green card. But the left will never go for that, because what they want is a blanket amnesty of everybody, because their agenda is not competitive otherwise without new demographics. And when they look at they salivate when they look at the electoral fate of New Mexico and California and Colorado, Nevada, and they think they can flip Arizona and Texas, and therefore they can keep winning elections based on identity politics.
You argue in this NR piece that for all the practical problems that arise from illegal immigration coming from Mexico, that there are also moral ones, that we've been too blithe about romanticizing the act of illegal immigration. So this is kind of the opposite of the Jeb Bush acts of love diagnosis. Explain what you think reactions like that get wrong.
Well, if you just came from Mars and you studied classical morality and ethics and legality, you would think, what is so noble about breaking the laws of your host, neighbor? And if the first thing you do is break the law, and then the second thing you do is break it again by staying in the United States, then everything from identity theft to running a stop sign to leaving the scene of the accident, which, by the way, half of all accidents in L.A. County, the perpetrator leaves the scene of the accident, it becomes easier to do. And then when Obrador gives these soapbox sermons, you ask yourself, what is so moral about sending your population in illegally and then telling, you know, the 200 million people who want to come from India, or the 100 million that want to come from Southeast Asia, or the 100 million that want to come from Africa, no, you can't come to the United States, you see, because racially and ethnically and nationally, we have claims on it and we're superior to you. And therefore, we're going to cut in front of the legal line. And that's just our birthright. And that's what he's basically saying. And then he's also saying to California, we're going to reverse your budgetary appropriations. It's not going to be 30% as it was in infrastructure investment. It's going to be 7%, and it's not going to be 7% as it was in Medi-Cal health expenditures. It's going to be 33%. So he has all these presumptions about some kind of innate ethical moral right to adjudicate how we in the United States live. And we just don't do that to Mexico. If I go down to Mexico and I cross the border illegally, and first thing I do, if I can't buy property, it's illegal. And then if I work, I will be deported. If I engage in politicking, I will be put in jail. And yet I can go a mile from here to Ringo Park and I can see illegal aliens for every type of political cause, both American and Mexican. We'll have Mexican candidates one week and the next week we'll have others. And so when people scream in my face in these marches that you know, the borders crossed us, we didn't cross the borders, it's historically ignorant and it's rude and chauvinistic. And it's basically the conservative backlash to it, or everybody's backlash to it, has to use moral terms and say to people, you mean you want to come here illegally and you want to come in the United States and stay illegally, and you don't think anybody else should be able to do it, not Russians, not Kenyans, not Thais or Filipinos, just you, because you're so morally superior and you're so racially and ethnically superior that you have a God-given right to do that. And we can't say anything because we're afraid of you, or we don't have your moral confidence. And I just don't accept those premises. And I don't, when I live in this community, and I can tell you that when somebody runs off the road and hits property of mine, which has happened on 4 occasions, and then leaves the scene of the accident, I'm not happy with it. I'm not happy when somebody dumps garbage in my yard. I'm not happy when somebody sprays graffiti on my mailbox. I'm not happy when somebody hits me in a car in a parking lot and takes off. And that's all a pretty much monthly occurrence. And I'm very unhappy when I meet people, mostly upper-class Asians and whites that live on the coastal corridors, when they start lecturing me with, we can't believe you wrote this about illegal immigration. And I always say, illegal immigration is not, you know, Jose cutting your grass and Yolanda cleaning your home and Consuela taking your changing your kids' diapers. It's just not it. And then you feel really good. You'll give them your used clothes, or maybe you'll even help pay for your funeral in Mexico, or you'll give them your secondhand car. And oh, wow, this is wonderful. But these people never say to themselves, where do they go home at night? What kind of housing do they have? Where do they go to school? Because they don't want anything to do with them. And when I go to take one example to Silicon Valley, I see 280, and then I look west and I see, I don't know, 250 square miles to the Pacific, about 20 miles north and south and about 40 miles east and west. And I say to myself, wow, that's a lot of land there. Why don't we have affordable housing for the other? If you want open borders, let everybody live there in Woodside all the way up to, you know, Belmont or something, and all the way to Half Moon Bay. And then when I say that, people get, oh no, I would never allow that to happen. If we had 2,000 young immigrants from Central America and their mothers and fathers living on the Stanford campus at the Quad, using Starbucks, playing on Stanford polo fields, mingling with the students, I don't think there would be any protest about, you know, that Trump is a Nazi. The protest would probably be, get these people out of here because they're not like me. So I'm starting to look at this whole thing as sort of a psychological mechanism where people who are not comfortable with Oaxacans construct a facade of liberal caring that squares a circle of their own guilt over their uneasiness with people not like them.
So
the final question that I'll put to you then, to what degree does it help or hurt to have Donald Trump as the vessel of getting tough on immigration? If you had another Republican president who held basically the same substantive immigration agenda, but without the Trump style, the Trump bombast, would that be less or more effective?
Well, we all dream of that, Troy. We all say, well, could somebody have Trump's forcefulness and uncompromising vision that he wants to restore sovereignty in the borders, but not his crudity, not his tweeting, not his rallies? And the answer is, I don't know how you create such an artificial creature, because they're so tightly embedded that what Trump is in a war, and basically the war that he's in is he inherited sanctuary cities, sanctuary states, open borders, and the idea the Democratic Party was going to bring in 50, 60 million people that were going to create a new identity politics foundation. And he was outraged by that, and they called him a Nazi, and they said everything to stop him. And then he replied in kind. But I can't think of a Marcus of Queensbury Republican, Mitt Romney or Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio, who would have been able to do much about illegal immigration. They would have compromised, or they would have been sober and judicious. And I wish Trump's language was more pleasant, but I can't think of anybody who speaks more pleasantly than he does that has the same commitment to close the border. And that's true in a lot of areas. We talked about that before, that, you know, in Shane or the searches, we just wish that John Wayne would be a little bit more polite and not almost want to kill Natalie Wood and the searchers. Or maybe Shane, when he, in that final scene, couldn't he just shoot Jack Palance in the hand, or, you know, wound him in the shoulder? Why does he have to kill three people? And the answer is, well, it's not a perfect solution, but when you have an existential problem and the existing solutions are either impractical or beyond your reach, then you look for people like that, and they come in and they bother you by the mechanisms and the comportment that they adopt. But it's a reflection on yourself, not them. And that's what we're doing. We don't have the confidence in our culture or laws to do it soberly and judiciously. So we have to invite in somebody like Donald Trump to do it for us. And we close our eyes and ears and say, you know what? Not in my name. That's not who we are. But it's not who we are either to let people come in without any verification of their background, or and see some of the things I've seen. I don't like walking through the country here, through an almond orchard, and seeing somebody beat the hell out of his girlfriend and then go over and say, stop it, and then have the girlfriend turn on you. And that's happened to me a couple of times.
Wow.
I don't like the idea of walking down my avenue and being attacked by, you know, 10 dogs, and none of them are licensed or have rabies vaccinations. And I knock on the door and the person says, no lo sé, no entiendo inglés, which, you know, lo siento mucho, all that stuff. And I expect him just to say, you know, I'm here in the United States. We've had a vaccination program for 50 years. My dog is vaccinated. He bit you. Don't worry about rabies. Not curl up in like a possum attitude and say, I don't know what's going on here. I don't speak English. But he does know what's going on, and he knows that I can't do anything about it. And that's creating a lot of frustration, and that's why Donald Trump, one of the two or three reasons he got elected.
All right. Topic I'm sure we'll be returning to in the future. Thanks to our listeners, as always, for tuning into the Classicist podcast. And if you enjoy the show, please rate it on iTunes. We'll be back with you soon. For Victor Davis Hanson, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.